From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. President Trump made a bold pronouncement in his State of the Union address earlier this month. He asked Congress to commit to eradicating HIV in the United States within 10 years.
Together, we will defeat AIDS in America and beyond.
Now, many health experts applauded, saying the president put forth a realistic, even if challenging, goal. But it's even more challenging in the South. The region now makes up more than half of new HIV diagnoses in America. And rural areas are hard hit as well, where public transportation and education are lacking. Poverty, access to resources, and a resistance to expanding Medicaid are also significant roadblocks. So this hour on Point, Southern states, HIV, and ending an epidemic. And you can join us. Have you been affected by the AIDS epidemic or an HIV infection? Has your community seen a change in HIV infection rates? What barriers have you encountered while trying to get tested, educated, or treated? What do you need to see from your state and local governments and from Washington as well? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Well, we're going to begin today in Atlanta, Georgia, with Nicole Roebuck, Executive Director of AID Atlanta, an HIV/AIDS service organization. Nicole Roebuck, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Meghna, for having me.
It's really great to have you. And I should say, first of all, that we were inspired to have this conversation about southern states in particular due to reporting in the Los Angeles Times. So a hat tip from them. But, Nicole, I first wanted to start off by playing a little bit more from the president's State of the Union address, where he talked about ending the HIV epidemic in the United States. Here's more of what the president said.
We have made remarkable progress in the fight against HIV and AIDS. Scientific breakthroughs have brought a once distant dream within reach. My budget will ask Democrats and Republicans to make the needed commitment to eliminate the HIV epidemic in the United States within 10 years.
That's President Trump earlier this month. Nicole Roebuck, when the president said that, what was your first response?
Well, actually, I was very happy to hear that it was even a part of his State of the Union address. I think that the fact that at that level that the issue of HIV and AIDS is highlighted is very commendable. So I was, first of all, happy to hear that it was an issue that his administration was interested in addressing. Mm-hmm. So that was the first reaction.
And then implying that there was a second reaction.
Second reaction was I am glad that as well that there is a statement about budget, because lots of times, you know, there may be a grand plan and not necessarily the resources that can back up that plan and ensure that the plan is implemented effectively so that services, care, medications, all of the things that are needed actually get to the people on the ground.
Yeah. So we'll talk more about what the federal government has put out, right? They have this plan, Ending the HIV Epidemic, a Plan for America, through the Department of Health and Human Services. But Nicole, give us a picture of what you've seen in Georgia over the past several years. Because, you know, as I introduced the hour today, I talked about how more than half of new HIV diagnoses in America are occurring in southern states here. So how has it changed in Georgia over the past several years?
Unfortunately, it's gone in the wrong direction. I've been at AID Atlanta in Atlanta for 18 years now. And when I got to the agency, Georgia was actually number 9 or number 10. And right now we're close to number 1. And so we've actually headed in the wrong direction.
Number 1 in infection rates?
Right.
Okay. Headed in the wrong direction. So that's actually a very significant change given how overall, over that same period of time, we began to start thinking of HIV infection as a survivable and preventable and controllable disease.
Absolutely. So it's actually very disturbing that this great state that we've actually not been able to do what is necessary to turn this issue around.
Okay, so tell me, what are a couple of the major factors you think have been sending Georgia in the wrong direction? Yeah.
I think there are a number of things. One huge factor is the issue of stigma and the issue of lack of access. So, for example, Georgia is a state that did not expand Medicaid, and therefore that kind of left thousands of people still reliant on federal free type programs like Orion Way program. Medicaid expansion would have allowed for at least 90% of the clients that we see to get on to Medicaid and have full comprehensive access to health care. So not only to take care of their HIV, but also to take care of other comorbid clinical conditions that may arise.
I see. So you're saying that those 90% of the people that you see, just to be clear, would have been significantly helped by Medicaid expansion.
Absolutely.
And so how is it? Tell me a little bit more about the challenges that they face in getting treatment and assistance now.
So we are heavily reliant on the federal Ryan White program.
Right.
And those funds are of course, limited. So they can't take care of everybody in the state that would have a need. The other huge issue is stigma in the South. Stigma is a huge problem in the South, how people view people living with HIV, the issue of HIV itself, and also the stigma that attaches based on homophobia and how people think about the LGBTQ community and how they're treated.
Mm. Well, Nicole Roebuck, stand by here for just a second, because I want to bring into the conversation Nick Carlisle. Nick is joining us from Birmingham, Alabama. Nick's executive director of the Southern AIDS Coalition, a former member of the Presidential Advisory Council on HIV/AIDS from 2016 to 2017. Nick Carlisle was one of the 10 members of that council dismissed in December 2017. Nick Carlisle, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. Thank you for having me on the show. It's a real honor to be here with you today.
Oh, well, it's a pleasure to have all of you on this program to talk about such an important topic. I mean, you heard Nicole there sort of describing the beginnings of some of the factors that have gone into, as she said, sending Georgia in particular in the wrong direction regarding the HIV and AIDS epidemic. Give us the bigger picture across the South here. Are those the similar forces that have led the region to be the kind of the new epicenter of HIV/AIDS in the country?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. You know, despite significant advances in diagnosis, care, and prevention, we continue to have a public health crisis in this country, and especially in the southern part of the United States. And you know, the reasons for that are myriad and complex, and include a sort of a confluence of healthcare policy and education, or lack thereof, including a real unwillingness to talk about sexual health education with our young people, and poverty, and a whole host of other factors. But one of the things that Nicole mentioned that I really did want to echo is that we know that HIV is an epidemic of intersectional inequality. So we know we're talking about racism, misogyny, homophobia, transphobia, and quite frankly, HIV-related stigma. And there's just simply no doubt that HIV-related stigma is significantly contributing to our epidemic in the South.
So can you tell us more about that, though? I mean, like specifically, how is that stigma contributing to it? Is it that people are fear seeking out testing? I've been reading that there are some, not just in the South, but across the country, there are still states that say that, you know, it can be a criminal act to have HIV, knowingly have HIV and infecting someone else. I mean, what are the specific ways the stigma is playing out?
Sure. I like to think of stigma in sort of two ways. So one is this more internalized stigma. So we're talking about really shame and the way that people living with HIV feel about themselves. And we have evidence that shows that kind of stigma is really negatively affecting health outcomes, including participation in healthcare and adherence to treatment and ability to get to viral suppression. And then we have that sort of externalized stigma, that kind of stigma that we experience from society more broadly. And I think that has had a really negative impact on people's willingness to get tested and to get linked to care and to stay into care. And you mentioned the issue around criminalization of HIV, which is a major concern all across this country and especially across the South.
Okay. Well, Nicole Roebuck, jump back in here for a moment because, I mean, we also should talk a little bit about more about education, for example, because perhaps one of the chief ways to push back on stigma is through education. Is there enough of that in schools in Atlanta where you are?
I don't believe there is. Again, and it's probably based on policies in education here in this state. So in terms of the types of sexual health education that exists for middle schoolers, for high schoolers, is very, it is very flat. It does not necessarily talk about the realities that kids are actually facing in terms of their sexual identity, their sexual activities. You know, there's almost like don't ask, don't tell, like as if kids are not having sex and they're having sex at a very young age. And I don't think that the schools are properly preparing our children for the realities that are out there, giving them the tools that if you decide to engage in sex, we're not saying you should. But if you decide that you're going to make that choice, that, you know, they have the education, the right education, and not myths or things they've heard from their friends, they have the right information, the science behind that information, so that they can make choices, because they're making the choices to have sex now. So I think it's our obligation as a school system to intervene and make sure that those our children have the right information and can make the choices, hopefully with their parents, with their families, to make the right decisions, but to protect themselves.
Well, Nicole Roebuck and Nick Carlisle, stand by here for just a moment. Just have to take a very quick break here. We're talking about HIV and southern states in particular. The region is considered sort of the new epicenter for HIV infection in the United States, and what needs to be done to bring the AIDS epidemic to a complete halt in the United States. We'll be back with a lot more. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about southern states and HIV and national efforts to really bring the HIV and AIDS epidemic to a complete halt and the particular challenges the South faces in doing so. And we're joined today by Nicole Roebuck. She's with us from Atlanta. She's executive director of AID Atlanta, an HIV/AIDS service organization in Georgia. Nick Carlisle is with us from Birmingham, Alabama, executive director of the Southern AIDS Coalition and a former member of the Presidential Advisory Council on HIV/AIDS in 2016 to 2017. Nick Carlisle was one of the 10 members of that council dismissed in December 2017. Nick and Nicole, I wanted to just get your view briefly, if I could, about the specifics around what the Department of Health and Human Services is proposing in terms of assisting 48 particular American counties who have very high HIV infection rates and several states as well that have a larger rural population who might have trouble accessing help here, right? So HHS is saying it wants to increase investments in these particular HIV hotspots through existing programs. I mean, Nicole, you'd mentioned the Ryan White HIV/AIDS program. They also want to use data to identify where the disease and the infections are spreading most rapidly, provide funds to create what they're calling a local health force in these areas to expand prevention and treatment. So, I mean, Nick Carlisle, these are the facets by which the federal government says it wants to reduce new infection rates by 90% in 10 years. Are these the things that the South in particular could benefit from?
You know, Megan, I'll start by saying, you know, we stand ready to work with anyone who's committed to ending the HIV epidemic in this country, and especially in the South. And that includes President Trump and his administration. This has never been and never should be a partisan issue. And, you know, we were really heartened to hear him talk at length about HIV in the State of the Union. But we're just beginning to understand the plan and just learning about the plan. Mm-hmm. And so I think this is promising. I think we are all very anxious and excited in the community to learn some more detail about it. But I think this is very promising. And I totally understand this need to really focus our resources on those hot spots. And we hear a lot about hot spots and hot pops. So hot populations are populations that are really marginalized and at risk for HIV. And so this makes sense to us, but we're anxious to learn more.
Right. So if I may, I can't tell if you're I hear a little bit of hesitation in your answer there. Is it because that we don't know the full sort of fleshed out plan yet? Or is it because you're concerned that maybe it's not exactly enough or what, you know, the region might need?
I think it's a little bit of both. You know, we're very optimistic in the South. That's one of the things I think, one of the attributes we bring to the table. And so we want this to be successful. We want the president to achieve his vision around HIV. But we know that there is a lot of work to do. And so there's a lot of detail. Okay. And as they say, the devil's in the details.
So let me then flip the question 180 degrees entirely. If you could write the plan for the Department of Health and Human Services, what would you do?
Well, I'd certainly make sure there was new money, and that's one of the most important things. And we talk about the investments that we need in the South, and those investments can't just be a reshuffling or a raiding of money from other places in the country. So we need new investment in the South, and that's one of the things that's most important. But we also need that money to be really flexible. And I think one of the things we know is that the South is not a monolith, and we have very unique communities across the South. You know, rural Alabama is different than urban North Carolina and different than Southern Florida. Mm-hmm. And so we have to give some deference to these local communities and these people on the ground in these communities who know best, like Nicole,
right,
who know best what needs to be done in Atlanta.
So Nicole, pick it up there. I mean, same question to you. If you could tell Alex Azar, the Health and Human Services Secretary, here is what we need specifically, what would you tell him?
I 100% agree with Nick. We need new money, not shuffled money. And I'll give a perfect example of that. The HOPA program, Housing Opportunities for People Living with HIV and AIDS, comes through the HUD, HUD federal government department. And those dollars have been shifted. And Atlanta is actually one of the cities that is going to be receiving a huge reduction in our funding over the next few years. And there are people right now, thousands of people right now, living in stable housing as a result of that HOPA program, people living with HIV, who are living, thriving on that HOPA program. And in a few years, we're going to be scrambling to figure out what do we do when there's a huge reduction to those funds. So what we cannot have in terms of the HIV/AIDS epidemic itself and the funding for that is a reshuffling of money. I 100% agree with that. The other thing I agree with is beyond just people on the ground like myself at an agency, we have to involve people living with HIV, mm-hmm. those people who are impacted by the decisions that the administration makes, that the Congress makes, that the Senate makes, that local governments make. We need to involve people who are impacted directly by this disease, and they need to be a part of the conversation as well.
Yeah. Well, let's go to the phones, if we may. Let's go to Jeff, who's calling from Binghamton, New York. Jeff, you're on the air.
Hi.
Go ahead, Jeff.
What do you want me to say?
Yeah, go ahead, Jeff. What's your thought today?
I just want to put a shout-out out there to anybody who's getting a brand-new infection. Don't lose hope. Don't think of it as the end of your life. Think of it as the beginning of your life. I've been battling the disease for 34 years, working on year 35. I'm a former AIDS educator and activist. I got my diagnosis in Ithaca when I lived in Ithaca and spoke at the universities and local schools. And at that time, it was dangerous to come out as a person living with AIDS. But those of us that did actually saw a curb in the rate of new infections and saw that go down. Now, unfortunately, it's gone back up the other way.
Mm. Well, Jeff, so you're saying that you think more people ought to, you know, just speak out, try to educate other members of their community?
It's very difficult to find people, especially young people, to come out and go before the camera, go before the audiences, and speak out about AIDS awareness and AIDS education. Currently, I'm not in activism anymore. I do my volunteer work in other areas of the community, but it is very much a part of my life.
Right. Well, Jeff, thank you so much for your call. Let's go to Wayne, who's calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Wayne, you're on the air.
Hi. My comment, and I just want to open as well, that I'm HIV negative, but this is certainly an issue I care deeply about. I wanted to expand on the issue of Medicaid expansion. Specifically in South Carolina, if we were able to have expanded Medicaid, there would have been an option for people who are at higher risk to prevent HIV. The brand name drug is Truvada. It's been out now, I think, for about a decade. And at least through South Carolina's Medicaid program, it's available on a fee-for-service basis or in some cases with a copay of like $3.40.
Right.
But because our state didn't expand the program, you have areas of our state that are low income, highly rural. They may not even have a hospital where, one, this conversation about HIV isn't happening, and two, there's no knowledge of a preventative measure that people at high risk, black young men, Hispanic young men, people with multiple sex partners, they don't know about this option as well.
Right.
And our state isn't allowing them to have it because our state refused to take our own money back to help our citizens.
Right. Well, Wayne,
other states across the South.
Exactly. So, Wayne, thank you so much for your call. Nick Carlisle, let me turn back to you on that because we heard earlier Nicole saying something very similar about Georgia. And we have been concentrating on, the federal level response here, but let's talk more about what state governments can do. I mean, both of you have said that you think that the lack of Medicaid expansion is a significant factor here. So can that be turned around at the state level?
Absolutely. And Wayne, thank you for your comment. We can't really have a conversation about ending this epidemic without talking about Medicaid expansion in the South. And I think if you heard any reluctance in our embrace of the president's State of the Union, we know that this administration has been hostile toward the Affordable Care Act and Medicaid expansion. And that simply is just incongruent with the idea that we would be able to make progress on the epidemic. I also wanted to really thank Jeff for sharing his story. And it's something I think we should talk about because we don't talk enough about the science and about some of the messages that people living with HIV and all of us need to know. The science says that if you're undetectable, you're essentially untransmittable. And what that means is a person living with HIV who is on medication and who is virally suppressed essentially cannot transmit the virus to others. And that really is a game changer for us. It's a game changer for people living with HIV, and it's a game changer for how we approach the end of the epidemic.
Yeah. Well, Nick and Nicole, stand by here for just a second, because as you both pointed out, the South is not a monolith by any stretch of the imagination. But we've been talking about sort of a mix of urban and rural areas, but I want to focus for a couple of minutes on Miami, Florida in particular. And first of all, let's listen to some tape of someone who suffers who is HIV positive. This is Natasha Dixon. She's HIV positive and suffers from a heroin addiction in Miami, Florida. She told the PBS NewsHour this past summer that she contracted HIV through needle sharing.
I mean, I've seen people pick up syringes on the ground to use them if they don't have anything to get high with. So, believe it or not, most of the people out here have it, whether they say it or not, So, I mean, everybody shares needles around here.
Well, joining us now is Dr. Deborah Holmes in Miami, Florida. She's an HIV specialist and the medical director of the AIDS Health Foundation Healthcare Center at the Jackson North Medical Center in Miami. Dr. Holmes, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me, Meghna.
It's really great to have you. So Miami, obviously a huge, diverse, you know, very key, important city in Florida and the South, for the country as a whole. Start at the beginning, though, for us here. What has been the drivers of the HIV infection rates in Miami?
Well, one of the big drivers, Megan, is Meghna, is poverty. Mm. Okay, of the top 25 metro areas in 2017, Miami had the second lowest median household income in the United States, and that was at about $51,000, and that was just $250 ahead of Tampa, and then Orlando came in third. And despite the facts of the not having a state income tax in Florida, the Florida figures were almost half of what the median household is in cities like San Francisco, you know, $96,000 a year, and D.C. So we have had the second highest number of percentage of people living in poverty of any metro area in the United States. Over 15% of the population in 2017 was living below the poverty line. We're talking about close to 1 million people, 921,000 people.
Wow. Okay.
Only ahead of us was Riverside, California. I didn't even know that fact. Yeah. So poverty is one of the drivers of the epidemic. And then we're talking about lack of awareness of status, stigma, housing, homelessness. You know, especially in the minority community, there was a study in 2004 that showed that close to 50% of the homeless were blacks. And coming up to 2016, there was a study by the U.S. Interagency Coalition on Homelessness, and they found that 44% of African Americans were being placed in permanent supportive housing. But why I'm bringing up this housing issue is that if you don't have, if you have unstable housing, this is you know a marker for just a complex interplay of many factors. You know, for survival.
Yeah, can I just jump in here for a second, because you know this is it's actually interesting because even though you know, Miami is this huge metro area. The forces that you're talking about are very similar to what Nick and Nicole were talking about in various other places in the South, right? We have this issue of either poverty or depressed socioeconomic populations who, because of that, have all sorts of instabilities in their lives, right? And all sorts of lack of access to the kinds of care, treatment, and education that could really, you know, put a stop to the spread of HIV here. So in Miami, though, I guess anywhere in the United States, ultimately, there's a question that there's a sort of a limited pot of funds or a limited set of things one can do. Where would you focus efforts in Miami?
Well, at AIDS Healthcare Foundation, we're the largest not-for-profit HIV provider globally. We have over 1 million patients. We're in 41 countries and 16 states. And I give high regards to our public health division. We do massive testing throughout the country and throughout the world. I mean, we are convinced that, and, you know, undetectable equals untransmittable, U equals U. This is how we're going to curtail the epidemic. We did over 4 million HIV tests globally in 2017, and domestically we did 186,000 plus every Wednesday night in my clinic. I'm next to Jackson North, but I'm not affiliated with Jackson. We can test up to 30 or 40 people in 2 hours, okay, rapid testing. And we're so efficient at testing that we now test at the Broward Health Department. We test sometimes over, you know, 100 to 200 patients a day in Broward, downtown Fort Lauderdale. So massive testing. When someone's diagnosed positive, link them into care, get them on antiretroviral medication, reduce the community viral load. San Francisco Department of Health got this many years ago.
Yeah. Well, so Nicole Roebuck, let me turn back to you here. Are you hearing sort of echoes in what Dr. Holmes is saying about Miami in terms of what your work and what you're seeing as challenges in Georgia?
Yes, absolutely. The issue of poverty, as I talked about, it was interesting, too. She raised the issue of housing, and we didn't even talk to each other beforehand. She also raised the issue of housing, and the issue of housing becomes a problem because of the issue of poverty. So those are all issues that our members, patients, clients are facing every single day. They have to make decisions about, do I pay my rent or do I get my medication?
Wow.
Do I, you know, eat, or do I take the train and go to my doctor's appointment? Those are the real situations that our patients are dealing with.
Well, Nicole Roebuck and Nick Carlisle and Dr. Deborah Holmes, stand by here for just a moment. We'll be back in about a minute or a minute and a half or so. We're talking about the South in particular and stopping the spread of HIV/AIDS. We'll be back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, the Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about southern states in the United States and how the region is the new epicenter for HIV infections in the United States and what should be done to stop it. We're joined today by Nicole Roebuck, Nick Carlisle, and Dr. Deborah Holmes. And I just want to hear a little bit, for example, from a voice from Oklahoma. This is Michelle Salvaggio, Medical Director of the Infectious Diseases Institute at the University of Oklahoma Health Sciences Center, one of two federally funded HIV clinics in Oklahoma. She told State Impact Oklahoma that the clinic used to employ a case manager in rural Woodward County, about 2 hours northwest of Oklahoma City.
We had to let that position go because nobody would go see her because they didn't necessarily want to be seen walking into the HIV case manager's office in that tiny town, because that can only mean one thing. I don't think that our state has necessarily gotten out of the idea that potentially HIV is, you know, a gay punishment.
So more stories there about stigma stopping people from trying to get help. Let's go to Marcus, who's calling from Morgantown, West Virginia. Marcus, you're on the air.
Hi, Megan. My name is Marcus Hopkins. I'm the project director of the HIV Hepatitis C Co-Infection Watch, which is a project of the Community Access National Network based out of D.C. One of my areas of research focuses on the opioid crisis and injection drug use as it relates to its spread of infectious disease.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're seeing in states like West Virginia and Indiana and other kind of Midwest and Appalachian states is that with the increase of injection drug use of both prescription drugs and illicit opioid drugs, we're seeing a marked increase in new HIV and hepatitis C infections. For example, in the state of West Virginia, over the past 2 years, in 2015, our rate of hepatitis C was 3.6. Our rate of hepatitis C in 2016 was 5.1, and in 2017, it was 9.1. So we have more than doubled our rate of new infections for hepatitis C. And in the past 3 years, we've had two public health crises announced by the State Department of Health and Human Resources that have indicated in states where injection drug use is highly prevalent, particularly in the southern part of the state. We're seeing new HIV infections climbing.
Yeah. Well, Marcus, thank you so much for your call, because we really should spend some time talking about this. Dr. Deborah Holmes, let me turn back to you. It seems as if there is some consensus amongst people, you know, working in the health field that injection drug use is one of the emerging places of emerging challenge when it comes to burgeoning HIV infection rates. Are you seeing that in Miami?
Yes, we do have a significant amount of intravenous drug abuse. Dr. Hansel Tooks, who's down at University of Miami, has implemented a pilot program for needle exchange, which he has been working hard at getting legislative approval for, you know, expanding this service in the state of Florida.
Well, I'm seeing here that you say he's working hard, but he hasn't yet convinced
legislators to expand it.
That's right.
No, this is a pilot program down at University of Miami, Jackson, I think, at Jackson.
Okay. And so the lack of enthusiasm around expanding that program, what does that tell you?
It's sad. It's, you know, so many countries have this service, and it's unfortunate. It needs to be expanded, that's for sure. There are many things. I'd just like to make a comment about the president's mention of trying to end the epidemic by 2030. Mm-hmm. I'm not encouraged by what I've seen so far, and I'm hoping that things will change, but he has failed to appoint a policy director for the White House Office of National AIDS Policy. This position has been vacant for 2 years. The Fenway Center for LGBTQ rights, a writer, Mr. Trenton Straub, summed it up in a nice commentary. And regarding the Peace Corps, he's dismissed members living with HIV and denied HIV-negative members access to HIV prevention, you know, the drug Truvada. Mm-hmm. There's been some undermining of the Affordable Care Act, the program which, you know, millions of Americans have used to obtain health insurance coverage.
Yeah.
So, you know, what we're seeing and what he has stated— and then, you know, Medicaid is really the single. Let me just make a comment. This is a very important fact. We at AIDS Healthcare Foundation had litigation against ACA, which is the Agency for Healthcare Administration, and Simply Healthcare, a for-profit plan down here recently. They have closed, effective February 28th, our not-for-profit Medicaid plan called Positive Healthcare. PHC Medicaid. And so we have close to 1,800 HIV-positive clients who have been serviced at many of our sites under AIDS Healthcare Foundation and elsewhere, scrambling to get into another Medicaid plan. Mm-hmm. The intention was to trying to put Medicaid patients in South Florida into Simply Healthcare.
Right. So
one plan for the state. Wow. I mean, it's crazy.
Yeah.
And so we had won our case. We tried to renew our contract for our not-for-profit plan for 5 years. We won the case in November or December, but ACA had the final say. And with little notice, they told us, oh, we're closing your plan February 28th. This was like a few weeks ago.
Wow. Okay.
So that does not say well for the state of Florida.
Yeah. So, Nick Carlisle, let me turn back to you here for a second, because the other thing that I just heard Dr. Holmes talking about is she sees inconsistencies coming out of the Trump administration regarding its view and approach to HIV/AIDS. I mean, you were on the Presidential Advisory Council on HIV/AIDS, dismissed in December 2017. I just want to get your view here. Even given the administration's current, you know, call and efforts, do you see inconsistencies that could undermine their overall goal of reducing HIV infection rates?
Yeah, of course I see inconsistencies, and I think that's why you hear reluctance in all of our voices on this panel today. But I don't want to let that. I want to be optimistic. And like I said before, you know, we want to work with any administration. And if the president is serious about really making progress on ending the epidemic, then we are here to do it with him. We just need to see a little more consistency and a little less attack on those things that we know undermine or are counter to our efforts.
Well, let's go back to the phones here. Let's go to Percy, who's calling from San Francisco. Percy, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call, Megan. Hey, I just wanted to a couple of things. First of all, warn Nicole that not to be stereotyping and broad sweeping everybody that lives in the South, because I live in the Castro district of San Francisco, and there's a tremendous amount of homophobic what have you people we run into constantly every single day, and we're in Queerville of Castro district.
Right. I mean, so like the historically the home of the LGBT community in San Francisco. So, OK, well, Percy, thank you so much for your call. Let's go. Actually, you know what? I want to just play one more piece of tape here because there's something, Nicole, I mean, Percy mentioned you, Nicole. I want to go back to something that you had started us off with, and that's this question of stigma. Because in the Los Angeles Times article that we saw that drew our attention to the particular challenges in the South, they have this quote here where Deja Abdul-Haq, who's the director of organizational development at My Brother's Keeper in Jackson, Mississippi, Deja Abdul-Haq says, "We're not talking about sex, essentially, in the legislature. We're not talking about it in the schools, and we're not talking about it in the church." And to that point, let's listen to Pastor William Francis, who is HIV positive and leads Atlanta Faith in Action. He told Al Jazeera in 2016 that he believes Christian communities need to do more to destigmatize AIDS and encourage people to get tested.
We have preached damning messages from our pulpits that have created stigma and a lot of self-stigma. And I think we have to get back to the Bible basics and preach love and acceptance.
So, Nicole Roebuck, I guess the question I want to turn to you is, we've been talking a lot about Medicaid, about the federal government, about policies. But should we also be talking about how other key components of the community can be part of a long-term solution in the South?
Absolutely. I think the community is actually the answer to the issue of HIV and AIDS. And as a result of that, for example, AIDS Atlanta has reinvigorated our faith-based efforts to go and reach out to the leaders of faith-based entities in Georgia, in Atlanta in particular, to try to help them in being a partner with us in terms of this HIV/AIDS epidemic, which is in their churches. Mm-hmm. And we have a lot of great allies, but we need much more of them. LGBTQ people, Black gay men, women are all going to church here in the South. And so there's definitely an opportunity for the faith-based community. I know Reverend Francis very well, and he is 100% correct. We have to start preaching the tenets of love and acceptance and tolerance and welcoming all into our communities. And yes, I think this is a community-based issue and needs a community-based solution.
Well, are the churches that you're reaching out to, are they receptive to this message?
Yes, thus far, actually. Okay. Yes.
Great. And Nick Carlisle, do you want to jump in there?
I do. I completely agree with Nicole. You know, at the end of the day, we know that the change we want to see has to happen at the local level with people who are directly impacted, who are leading the charge and getting involved. And that's nowhere is that more evident than within our own movement, you know, where people living with HIV for 30 plus years have really changed the course of this epidemic. And I think, you know, you asked me earlier what I would do differently or if I had the power to create the plan for HHS. And the thing that the most important thing I would do is make sure that people living with HIV and those of us who are disproportionately impacted are really at the center of that plan and informing that plan and driving that plan and executing that plan.
Okay, interesting. Well, Deborah Holmes, we've got about a minute left to go in this conversation. And I'm just wondering, I sort of asked a similar question to Nicole and Nick a little earlier, and I wanted to turn it to you here. Do you think the president's stated goal is doable, that within a decade we could cut down new infection rates of HIV by 90%?
If there was a consolidated effort to do massive testing, have access to care, whether it be under Medicaid, Ryan White, which I would like everyone to know is available for anyone who's uninsured, who fulfills the guidelines, because too many people fall out of the emergency room with critical illnesses and out of the hospital, never heard of Ryan White, or don't think that they can get care because they don't have insurance. But if there was a consolidated effort to work together, a uniform effort for massive testing, linkage to care. I'd like to get out there that PrEP is great and does serve a function. It can reduce transmission in those who need it by over 90% if used. However, a condom is far cheaper, and PrEP, I'd like to say, does not prevent the acquisition of other sexually transmitted diseases. A couple of last year, a year before, we had an explosion of syphilis, so much so in this country that we ran out of penicillin
wow.
to treat. It was being reserved only for pregnant people. Yeah. But I'd also like to encourage everyone to do to get tested. If you've never been tested, you can go to freehivtest.net. Mm. And plug in your zip code and find somewhere near you where you can get a free HIV test.
Well,
Dr. Holmes, is critical.
It is critical. And forgive me for having to interrupt you here, but we're just out of time for this conversation.
Sure.
So Dr. Deborah Holmes and Nick Carlisle and Nicole Roebuck, I want to say thank you to all three of you for giving us your expert view and view on the ground there about what it will take to curb HIV infection rates in the South. Thank you all so very much today. And folks, we had to wrap up there because I wanted to offer a clarification on something you heard on yesterday's show. So we're going to take a couple minutes to do that because yesterday we were talking about Democratic Senator Amy Klobuchar's record in Minnesota. That was our effort to illuminate Klobuchar's 2020 presidential run by examining her actual record in her home state. So in that show yesterday, I read a Facebook comment from listener Tess Dornfeld, and she asked the guests to address, quote, Klobuchar's actions in northeastern Minnesota. The portion I read did not mention what specific actions Tess was referring to, so our guests could only offer speculative responses. However, Tess's comment did contain additional context. She wanted to know specifically about Klobuchar's, quote, support of sulfide mining against the interests of the majority of her constituents, the local economy, clean water, and tribal sovereignty, end quote. Now, we should have read that portion of the comment, too, and not doing so made things confusing, and we missed an opportunity to add important information to the program, and we do apologize for that. So with that in mind, here is more context on what actually turns out to be one of the most contentious issues in Minnesota politics right now, according to David Schultz, professor of political science at Hamline University. He was a guest on our show yesterday, and we reached out to him again for more on Klobuchar and Minnesota mining.
Amy Klobuchar has weighed in on the side, in some cases, of some of the mining companies taking action to try to urge federal agencies to support environmental permits to be able to allow for the mining.
Well, the most controversial mine is a $1 billion, 19,000-acre mine currently under development in northeast Minnesota. The Polymet mine would be Minnesota's first copper nickel mine. And the company says it would bring jobs to an economically depressed region of the state. Environmental groups say that the mine will pollute critical waterways, including Lake Superior. So last year, Senator Klobuchar co-sponsored an amendment tucked into a defense spending bill that would have finalized a land swap between the U.S. Forest Service and Polymet Mining. It would have also effectively ended lawsuits seeking to stop this exchange. The amendment was removed in conference committee. Again, here's David Schultz.
Many people accuse the supporting of the mining interests as a sellout to corporate interests. Others argue it is a reasonable compromise between jobs and the environment. But at least in this situation here, Klobuchar has taken action as a senator to try to bring about mining and to support mining in the Iron Range area of the state.
Now, Minnesota state and federal regulators have approved most of Polymet's required water and air permits. As of late last year, one wetlands permit from the Army Corps of Engineers remains. Construction at the mine could begin this spring, but just yesterday, environmental groups filed a new lawsuit against the EPA saying the agency did not publicly disclose concerns it may have about the Minnesota mine. So this is a really fascinating issue. We've got some links to terrific local reporting from Minnesota on this. Go to onpointradio.org for that. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.